Welcome to the Oklahoma Watch Out Forum. Our topic this evening is women and mental health. I'm David Fritze, executive editor of Oklahoma Watch. If you don't know who we are, we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. We produce investigative and in-depth stories on a range of public policy issues facing the state. Tonight, we will discuss the sort of often unique mental health issues that women face in different life situations, whether they're incarcerated, suffering from depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, or dealing with anxiety issues as a professional, a parent, or a young person. I would like to welcome our guests. We have Dr. Nicole Washington, staff psychiatrist at Family and Children's Services, Roxanne Hinther, clinical director of Women in Recovery, and Janet Cizek, CEO and managing partner of the Center for Therapeutic Interventions. Thank you for being with us this evening. Before we dive into questions, I would like to recognize and thank the following organizations: the Ann and Henry Zero Foundation and Zero Families Foundation for enabling this event and our year-long series on mental health called Troubled State, a series on mental health in Oklahoma. Also, our primary funders, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation and the George Kaiser Family Foundation. And then we would like to recognize our Tulsa community partners, the Oklahoma Public Media Exchange, helping provide audio services, and Circle Cinema for donating this theater space. So I'd like to start by mentioning, this is a topic we've covered quite a bit, but I would argue that we're in a golden age for treatment of mental health. We long ago sort of threw out of the boat the cult of Freudian psychoanalysis. We have medications that we never had before, with more on the way. We are imaging the brain and researching genetics to develop even better treatments. And yet, and so in short, we can treat mental illness more effectively than ever before. At the same time, mental health problems seem to be everywhere. They seem to be talked about and discussed in the media, and especially for women who suffer from some unique mental illnesses. So I'd like to ask first Dr. Washington, why this paradox? What is Oklahoma? Why is Oklahoma, and women in particular, why do they seem so troubled?
That's a big question. I think you're right in that now we have available to us better treatments than we've ever had, but I also still think that mental health itself and the brain is still kind of our last frontier in medicine. I think we have really good ideas of cardiac things and lung functions and other organs in the body, and I think the brain still is, we still have a lot left to learn. We know a lot more than we did, but I think we still have a ways to go. You're right, women do tend to suffer from anxiety disorders more than men. You know, is that because of just inherent differences in women and men, the hormone differences, genetic differences? Is that because women present more than men to be diagnosed with those things? Mood disorders, you know, you're going to have with bipolar disorder, it's about equal, but the way they present is a little bit different. Depression maybe a little more in women. But, you know, why is that? Is it women, or is it that we're the ones going in and being evaluated and being diagnosed? Is that what's happening? Also, there are lots of things that play into mental health issues that have nothing to do with medicine, that have nothing to do with drugs, that have everything to do with societal pressures of being a woman and social determinants of health that get in the way of people's mental health or lack thereof. You know, so I think all those things kind of play a role, and we have to think about the whole picture and the whole thing instead of just focusing on the tools that we have available to us right now.
Ms. Cizek, I'd like to ask you, women, I guess many people would argue that women are so needed for sanity in this world. So when a woman is mentally ill, what are the effects on her and those around her?
Well, I think personally the effects can be very stigmatizing. So to feel that they may not want to seek treatment, they may be afraid to seek treatment. But I also think that most women are going to be moms or are already moms or are caregivers in some capacity. And so when women are affected by mental illness, their parents may also be affected if they're in the sandwich generation, and their kids are also affected by mental illness, either because vicariously they have a parent, a mom, who may be suffering with mental illness or addiction, or just by simply having generational mental illness themselves.
So for women that you see in your center, what within their own lives, what are some of the debilitating effects, I assume, that come from depression and some of the other mental health problems that women have? I mean, how does it affect their lives? What is the cost?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the cost to them could be their life. I mean, some women die from mental illness or addiction. The cost could be they can no longer work. They lose their jobs or cannot function because they're either afraid to get treatment, or there isn't access to treatment, or there isn't funding for treatment. And so the cost to society, I think, is like $600 billion from mental illness untreated.
Ms. Hinther, Women in Recovery, a diversion program for women who may be headed off to Mabel Bassett or another institution. I assume that you see women who have already spent time in prison as well as those who never make it there in diversion programs, right?
Currently, there's about 30% of our population of women in recovery participants that have been in Department of Corrections in the past.
So how do you think that your program helps them, that the prison system, in ways that the prison system would not? I mean, they have some treatment within prisons, right? But how does your program help, and are the prison systems insufficient in providing any treatment?
So Women in Recovery is a very holistic treatment intervention for female offenders in Tulsa County. We are primarily funded through the George Kaiser Family Foundation, and are able to provide the women with really wraparound services from housing. We're able to pay for urine drug screens, all the kind of situational stressors that they would have if they were having to pay for everything on their own. And that way they're able to really just focus on themselves, getting healthy again, learning how to live a life of sobriety and recovery. And then we really do a lot of work around trauma for them. We have a lot of intensive treatment services, so they're able to engage from the beginning in 8 hours of group counseling per week. They're able to also participate in education classes, so life skills, budgeting, anger management. We do dual generational work where we're able to help them with parenting skills. We provide them with parenting education on a weekly basis, and we have a parenting team that works with them on child-related issues, because about 84% of our women have children.
So do you see certain problems that are greater than others for women who are headed for prison, were it not for your program?
Oh, they all have trauma. Trauma is a huge piece for them. I think that the women experience early childhood trauma, and it just compounds as they progress in their disease of addiction. They put themselves in unsafe situations in order to survive in a really hard world, and it just continues. So 100% of them have traumatic experiences, at least one, oftentimes more. And I would say that's the biggest piece. They've been on average in their addiction 13 to 15 years, and our average age is 30.
Addiction, what, mostly to drugs, alcohol, which?
Yeah, our primary drug is methamphetamine that our women have been abusing, and then opiate pills is top second for sure.
Dr. Washington, what are some of the cultural factors do you think that weigh upon women's mental health?
I think in general, women are nurturers, in general, in generalities. And so I think what I see often is women putting everybody else's needs around them before their own. So then they're not going to their appointments because they have to make sure the kids have what they need, and is the spouse or significant other okay, or are they taking care of other relatives, parents, other children in the family that aren't their biological children? Do they have so many responsibilities that just the ability to get to the doctor, and not just, you know, mental health, but physical health as well, you know, they tend to ignore all these things. So I think that's a big one, is just the role that we tend to expect women to play in society and how that gets in the way of them being able to care for themselves and have the permission to be broken without being seen as this over-emotional crazy lady who, you know, is difficult to deal with.
You mentioned, like, the emotional factor. You don't want to stereotype. You know, there is that stereotype. Women are more emotional. They're going to be depressed more often or more troubled. But let me ask, are there biological factors at work here for women that would put them more at risk for certain kinds of mental health problems?
Definitely, as women age, I think we have to think about our women who are approaching menopause and who are in that stage of life and hormone changes and things that happen. I think that as we're having children and we're having all these hormone fluctuations, and there are just going to be normal changes that happen to us that are going to make people consider us to be that crazy lady, you know, super emotional woman. Some of that's okay, but I think we don't always allow it to be okay. And other people don't always give us permission in our lives to let that be okay. So I think that's it. I mean, yes, women get diagnosed with depression more than men. Women get diagnosed with anxiety disorders more than men. But like I said, is that lack of presentation on the male side? Is that the hormonal differences? Is that just some genetic difference between men and women that we just haven't really yet uncovered? I don't think we know that yet.
Do you think, Ms. Cizik, do you think that women, that men get more attention for the mental health problems? And I'm thinking specifically of violent antisocial acts. You know, you see the shootings in Tucson, or the shootings in Colorado, and you know, the man who storms the Capitol and knocks over the Ten Commandments monument. It seems like these get the headlines. Do you think the women's problems with mental health are overshadowed or not?
I definitely think that women are overshadowed. I think that women suffer not as intensely over a long period of time. So they may be suffering with mental illness for 10 years before anybody ever says, wow, this may be a significant mental illness or addiction, as opposed to just, you know, as Dr. Washington said, the crazy lady. I think men typically do something really intense and violent and get attention, and typically are diverted to prison or something along those lines. I think women can follow those same lines, but it seems like they hide it because there is a real stigma for women who are supposed to be able to caretake to not be able to pull it together for themselves. But we know this is a brain disorder. This has nothing to do with not having strong enough willpower, not being, you know, good enough or smart enough. It's a brain disorder. It's a health condition. We would never say to a man who needed to go for heart health, wow, you should be really ashamed that you haven't taken better care of yourself. But a lot of times those are kind of the social messages that we get as women, that it's not okay. You should be able to figure this out and take care of it, or hush and go back into the closed doors. A lot of women who have mental illness and addiction may or may not be in a domestic violence relationship, and so they may not be able to seek treatment. They may not be in fear of their own lives, of you know, asking for help. So they tend to suffer in silence, from my experience.
For women who don't feel at risk for their own safety, wouldn't they not be more inclined to acknowledge problems and to seek and get help? Or is that not, you know, does that not really overcome the barrier of the stigma?
I don't think so. Sometimes when women seek treatment, they either go to a primary care doctor who may say, here is a you know, here's Prozac, and they may not go into in-depth or make the additional referral to a mental health professional where somebody can do a full-fledged screening and assessment to ask about the trauma, the childhood trauma or the adult trauma. Because, you know, as Roxanne mentioned, women who have addiction tend to put themselves in risky situations and may be sexually assaulted, may go into prostitution to continue to get their drugs on the street. And so it's a perpetual cycle sometimes of really, really getting severe to where they lose their children because of a DHS referral or are diverted to the prison system or something along those lines. So by the time, and it's usually 10 years where nobody has stepped in or there hasn't been some appropriate intervention.
Ms. Hinther, you mentioned trauma. So I guess I would ask, is a lot of women's mental health issues, do they have to do with men?
I know all mine do. sorry. I think that women, moms, we take care of everyone first. I know that a lot of the women that I work with have been involved in multiple domestic violence relationships from early on. A lot of times that's what was role modeled to them as well in their childhood. I've had women tell me, if he doesn't hit me, I don't think he loves me. So I think that, that trauma certainly compounds things, and all of us are, most of us are wanting romantic relationships or wanting to find that special someone, and I don't think that these women are any different than anyone else with wanting to find love and happiness. They just struggle with figuring out who's the right person for that relationship.
Well, let me just ask as a follow-up, just for women in general and men in general, what advice would you give men to help women's mental health?
Oh, patience. I think in any relationship, patience is important on both parties.
Anyone else on that?
Yeah, I'll add something.
Sure.
So I think that we should not ignore things and to check in and to ask. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a man, but 1 in 4 people are going to have a diagnosis of mental illness or addiction in Oklahoma, 1 in 4. And so what we can all do is begin to reduce stigma by asking, are you okay? Seems like something might be wrong. Not judging or blaming, but asking, is there something going on? You seem different. You seem on edge, you know, non-blaming kind of things so that we can help people. We have to start doing this as a society. This is not a moral issue. This is a health issue. And probably by far, as Dr. Washington said, the last frontier, this is the public health crisis of our time. And we have to start focusing on that as the issue, not it's a man's fault, it's anybody's fault. It's a health issue that we all have to start addressing and checking in with people and getting people somewhere, you know, contacting 211 if you don't know what resources are out there. But we have to begin to all work together as a community to help people.
Another probably great support for loved ones, family members is Al-Anon. That's a great support for those important people in in our lives.
Dr. Washington, on the topic of stigma, it seems so intractable. I mean, it seems like decades ago there was a lot of talk about going to your psychiatrist and giving psychoanalysis and lying on the sofa, and everyone was talking about it. It's in the movies. Woody Allen made it famous. And now it seems like it's even more closed than it was before, although we've moved beyond that period. So what can be done to reduce the stigma?
I think everybody has to do something. Everybody from the way media portrays when we have these major headlines, the way that media, the words they use to describe the people with illness who have perpetrated these crimes, you know, the words that they use, the way that we portray people with illness in movies, the way that we, just the way that in general people are seen. If you don't have a big history of illness, what you know about people are based on things you've seen on TV or movies or what you see in headlines when someone does something that makes the news. I think those things are important. I think that community organizations, churches, civic organizations, I think we all have to change the way that we talk about it and think about it. I think that can help with stigma. I think that we should be teaching children early on about depression and what it is and anxiety and illness and what do you do instead of making it this very taboo thing that we just don't talk about. And so I think it's a multi-level problem, and all of us play a part in adding to the stigma.
And, you know, in the media, I'll mention, we're sort of feel caught between a rock and a hard place. You know, newspapers, we don't write about suicides. We're afraid that we're going to promote more suicide. If we quote someone who is mentally ill, we're always very sensitive, and rightfully so, to whether we use their name or not, because they just don't want their name used. Others are just out front with it. But it's hard to get beyond that without feeling like you're risking somebody's job, their life, their reputation, et cetera. And a lot of people just don't come out and talk about it. But
I want to reiterate, you're not going to make somebody commit suicide if you say something. You're not going to make somebody depressed if you say, why are you not getting out of bed? You know, you can't do that. So I think that's the fear that we have, because as a society, we don't really know a lot about mental illness, and we haven't been taught about mental illness. Just as Dr. Washington said, we have to start having the conversations all the time with everyone we know and start talking about, hey, I have a neighbor, I have a sister, I have a brother. It's all around us. So there shouldn't be anything stigmatizing about talking about mental illness and addiction. We all know someone. We all have someone in our family if we're not ourselves personally struggling.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to open questions up to the audience. We have two people with microphones, but before we start with random questions, I'd like to recognize that we have the director of the Mental Health Association Oklahoma, Michael Brose, in the audience, and I wanted to invite him if he wanted to offer anything in terms of how you reach out for help and any other thoughts just in general about women and mental health. And if you'll raise your hand. Oh, good. Well, question two. That's permitted. If we could use the microphone, that'd help.
Well, first of all, I just want to honor you guys with Oklahoma Watch for doing this, and the women up here who are incredible leaders and out there in our community, treating people, helping people in ways that we can't fully appreciate or even imagine unless you're in that line of work and do what they do for men and women. But I just want to honor you guys for that. But again, we as Mental Health Association, we always want to be a source of a resource for people. And one of the roles we play a lot in the community and in the state is linkage. And people turn to us and they have no idea where to go to sometimes. Sometimes you've heard me say it many times, our mental health care system is difficult sometimes to access. And so that's one of the roles we play. But I wanted to ask a question about one of the subsets. Is I've gotten to know Chrissy Smith. I don't know if you guys have had a chance to meet her. If you haven't, I hope you do. But she is really being a flag bearer right now for postpartum depression, trying to bring awareness to that. And I'd like to hear some response or comment about that, is your perceptions about how good a job or not we're doing about treating women after birth in terms of those that identifying and treating them appropriately and validating postpartum depression, because I think many times she's helped me understand that she didn't feel validated, and she talks to other women who don't feel validated with in postpartum depression. That's a real, very real thing, and I'd really appreciate if you guys would maybe comment on that.
Who would like to take that? Doctor?
I think that doctors do a horrible job of that in general. In general, I think we're pretty bad at it. Psychiatrists know about postpartum depression, but we don't see those ladies. We're not seeing them. The pediatricians are seeing them because those little ones are going in for appointments. The obstetricians are seeing them for follow-up visits from delivery or from C-sections or whatever type of birth they had, they are the ones who are following up. And I just think as a whole, we sometimes miss it. Pediatricians are very busy. OB-GYN docs are very busy. There's limited time. You know, I think sometimes they feel the pressure of, I just don't have time to go there, you know. And there are lots of emotional changes that happen right after delivery. So I think it takes even more time to wade through, is this just what we call postpartum blues? Is this just, I had a baby and I hadn't slept in however many days and I'm just exhausted? Or is this something more? And it takes time to dig into all of that. And I think that those doctors just don't have the time because they have a waiting room full of people and a busy schedule or people laboring at the hospital or lots of things going on. So I think in general, we just haven't quite figured out in medicine how to evaluate that appropriately, because they're the ones that see them at the critical moments, not us. I don't see those ladies.
I think also a lot of women, not just postpartum depression, but also postpartum anxiety. Mm-hmm. So I know they asked questions after the six-week checkup about depression, but there wasn't questions about anxiety. So I don't know what the prescribers do, the OBs and pediatricians do. If you answer yes to those questions, maybe they just evaluate further for medications and antidepressants. So.
Probably varies. I'm guessing it varies from doctor to doctor. Some may not ask at all. Some may ask and make a referral. Some offices may have social workers who may try to link. I think there's no consistent method, I think.
And I really wish that our healthcare system, since we know this exists and it's pretty high statistically that women will have postpartum depression, why are we not doing that? Even pediatricians, social workers at hospitals, nurses, you know, we have lactation specialists who call you the second you have a baby and want to help you. Why are we not asking 10 simple questions to determine if a woman has postpartum depression? Because think about that. That begins the generational. If the woman cannot bond with her baby in the first 6-8 weeks, there could be some mental health issues in that baby. I mean, beginning because the baby isn't bonded. So I think it's a few little things in our healthcare system as a whole that we need to start shifting to preventative care and addressing things in the beginning, as opposed to 15 years later when we have a juvenile delinquent with, you know, attachment disorder because mom had postpartum depression and never got treated or even diagnosed.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? There's one over here.
So following up on the postpartum depression, I read an article recently that I would love for you to comment on that talked about some mental illnesses beginning as a symptom as an infection or a disease or a virus. So for example, if a woman goes through childbirth and loses blood and she's anemic, her body may be dealing with some inflammation and healing, certainly, that depression may present as a symptom. Her body is indicating that she needs more rest, she needs to take it easy, and then it can become a chronic issue.
I think that goes back to that we're still trying to figure it out in mental health. There are in the past couple years, there have been some studies with depression and anti-inflammatories, and there have been some studies because of that reason, because now someone came up with a theory of maybe this is an inflammatory process. We know there have been theories for years about schizophrenia and people who develop schizophrenia. Maybe they were born during the winter months. There's more incidence of schizophrenia among people born during the wintertime, and there's been a thought of maybe those mothers contracted some type of virus that the fetus was exposed to in utero. I think those are still the things that we're still trying to figure out, and there's research constantly with different things trying to figure it out. We still just don't really know. And I think we still have years to go before we have the kind of answers we're looking for.
To your point, it gets to that question of whether specialists or primary care doctors even pay attention and even ask those simple questions. We've heard concerns that most doctors, if you go in for just a general checkup, they never even ask you about your mental health. They don't ask how you're feeling.
And I don't want us to pick on. I don't want us to pick on.
That's all right.
The doctors,
you can go ahead.
Because I don't think. I think most of us who go into medicine because we want to help people. I don't know anybody who went into medicine and said, you know, I really don't care for people that much, and I don't really want to help anybody. Nobody does that because of the training and the grueling nature of it. We all, in some way, want to help people. I think what happens, it's more of a maybe even a medical education thing. I went into psychiatry, so I got a lot of psychiatric training. My friend, who is an internist, had a 4-week psych rotation as a third-year medical student, and that was it. And so they, you know, she had 4 weeks as a student following a psychiatrist around, but didn't really get a lot of exposure to that kind of thing. But yet, she treats a ton of depression and anxiety in her practice as a primary care doc, as an internal medicine doc, as a family medicine doc, as a gynecologist. And gynecologists serve as primary care docs for a lot of women of childbearing age because they're not going to the doctor for any other reason except their annual exams because they're otherwise healthy people. So they had a 4-week, 6-week, if they were lucky, 8-week rotation as a medical student, and that would be the equivalent of asking me to operate on somebody. I had a 4-week surgery rotation. I don't feel well equipped to go do surgery on anybody because that's all I had. I'm a psychiatrist. And so I think, you know, unfortunately, because there is a shortage of us, these primary docs are asked to do a ton of things in a very short visit. So if I only have 12 minutes with somebody and I have to chart for 3 or 4 of those and I have 8 minutes to get it all in,
true,
and I have to deal with the diabetes and the heart disease and the blood pressure and everything else, and then, oh, by the way, you know, how's your mental health? That's more than a 2-minute check-in.
Right.
So I think our system in general just doesn't, which speaks to the need for more integrative model in medicine where we are all working together and it's not just, oh, this doctor is responsible over here and over here. We really should be finding ways to work together more where we're able to do that and kind of help each other out. We all have different skill sets, but we need to bring them together.
Other questions? Right there.
Yes. Dr. Washington, I think you should give surgery a try. But that aside, I comment first about WEIR that one of the best things that they do is community integration. My mother went to prison for manufacturing of meth, and she just got released with no help. So that was, you know, pretty difficult for us at the time. And then I guess my other question is about women professionals in mental health. I know that mental health tends to be a female-dominated field, but are there still instances of sex discrimination that you encounter in your work? And this is for all three.
Ms. Cizik, would you like to take that?
Well, that was like a 5-part question. So I think there are great reintegration programs all around our state. I think the real problem is they're not funded appropriately or adequately to treat women who are coming out of prison. So that was the first question. And I definitely think we need more programs. I think that we have done... you know, Oklahoma, I think we incarcerate more women than any other for nonviolent offenses. And I believe that we've done that for so many decades that now we have women who've been gone for 20 years from their lives, and we definitely need more funding for that. Second question was, I think that you are correct. We are in a female-dominated, as far as counseling, I think there are quite a few psychiatrists that are men. But I don't really feel discriminated against. I definitely think we as women talk, you know, coworkers, we talk about depression and anxiety, and we check in on each other quite frequently. I don't know that the male counselors that I work with do that so much. They kind of are the stability as far as going that. So were those your questions? I want to make sure that I
think I probably see the discrimination part then more than you, because medicine is and has been this kind of male-dominated area. There are a lot more women going into psychiatry. It's a lot more appealing for women just because of lifestyle. You know, one of the main reasons I chose psychiatry, I have a family, I have kids, I wanted to be there for my children. I didn't want to be at the hospital all wild hours of the night, and I wanted to be home. So that made it more appealing. I think there are a lot more women going into the field as psychiatrists. But in general, I think it's little things. It's never really big things. It's little things. It's the I can have a male resident medical student with me who work under me, and they will patients will refer to them as doctor, and I am Miss Washington. Just never fails. Just multiple times a day, I am Miss Washington. I am Mrs. Washington. Never, I rarely get called doctor, actually, by patients for the most part. Like, I'm family members don't, it's just one of those things. I've been confused, you know, even in hospital settings. Oh, the nurse is here. There's nothing wrong with being a nurse, but I'm not one. And so I don't, you know, I've been confused for housekeeping in a long white coat. I've been confused for social work. I've been, it's Miss. And my female, you know, my female peers have had the exact same things, you know, and our male counterparts just don't ever really get called Mr. So-and-so. They tend to always get referred to as doctor, and we tend to be Miss whoever, you know. So it's little things like that. I haven't had any big problems, but it's little things like that.
I wanted to play off one thing you mentioned with your mother getting out with no assistance. Now, Ms. Hinther, you're on the front lines of some of that. And
I am.
So my question is, even though women are diverted from prison, like I said, some women have already been there and are coming to you for the second sentence or third sentence. So how much help do they get in prison? What's your impression?
Well, the women in my program that have been incarcerated in the past would say that there's not much help in prison. Oftentimes there's long wait lists, and the way that you serve your time, you get a certain number of days for each day that you spend there. And so often, because we are incarcerating in our state low-risk female offenders, they're not in for a very long period of time, and so they're not eligible for the programs that are available. I agree that treatment options are a great investment in these humans' lives, because they're going to come back into our community, whether it's as better criminals with no help, or getting treatment and having some resources available and a little bit more knowledge about the disease of addiction.
Mm-hmm. We did a series package recently and found that, well, a couple of stories really, that therapy sessions have declined in prison, so that's less treatment. But there are a lot of psychotropics being prescribed. And so my follow-up question to that is, one person told our reporter they felt they'd been given the wrong drug that wasn't working, and they felt zombified was the word they used. So there's always this sort of rumor that, you know, the prison system is giving them prescription drugs just to, you know, like take your soma and be quiet so we can manage you well. And it's not really having any long-term beneficial effect. I'd like to hear from Ms. Hinther and Dr. Washington on that.
I think when you're doing time in prison, you have a lot of time. So offenders would like to avoid at any cost, at any chance that they can, and so they will often misuse the medications that can be prescribed in prison or in jails because they want to sleep. They want to not deal with the loudness of the facility that they're in, and they're just waiting out their time until they can leave and go home.
I think there is that. That happens a lot. It's a tough one for me. So the other end of that, I think, is that in general, I spend a lot of time telling people what they don't need when they are telling me what they do need. And so I think in general, if you're taking away therapy programs, but yet the medication is still there, some things medication just won't treat. You know, I tell people all the time that I can give them enough medicine to where they are drooling and wetting their pants in the corner, and it's not going to change the fact that you're in jail and you're locked up, mm-hmm. or change the fact that when you leave here, you're going to go home and you have no lights and no water and you have, like, that's not going to fix that. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to also allow people to be okay with being uncomfortable and feeling things, because you're human and feelings are normal. Mm-hmm. And I spend a lot of time just really trying to work people through how to handle that without their first thought being, I need a whatever, mm-hmm. because it's going to
It's nice when our our areas can work together.
And so it's just very difficult, though, because people get into a habit of, I feel uncomfortable, I need something, which is what the addiction cycle is about. It makes it hard to treat people who've had an addiction at some point because that's their go-to. Like, I feel something icky. I don't want to feel this.
Kind of how our society is.
Yes, mm-hmm. Like, I don't like this. Fix it now. And so that is a problem because mm-hmm. that's not realistic and people feel things. It's the way we were designed.
Well, and I also think some of the psychotropic meds that are used, irregardless of prison or not, some of them have pretty severe side effects. And women or men or whoever's seeking treatment, they need to advocate with their medical professional to say, I really don't think this is working. Is there something else along with therapy? Mm-hmm. But sometimes it takes a little bit of finesse to get medications right.
And unfortunately, in most prison systems, the formulary is limited. They don't have access mm-hmm. to a lot of medications. The ones they do have access to are really old and may be the ones that have more side effects associated with them. So that brings on, you know, a problem. And that system is having just as much difficulty with shortages of psychiatrists as other areas. And so if you have one psychiatrist to manage two or three, you know, systems in a region, that brings on a problem. Or you have one person who comes in once a week. They don't have a lot of time to do a lot of follow-up and do that fine-tuning, you know, that needs to happen. Or even really get to know those people well enough to say, well, I don't think you need this. I think you just need therapy. Or I think our system is broken.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Over there.
Hi, my name is Janice Jones. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Just the Beginning. And recently, you all are phenomenal, and I'm learning so much. That's the reason why I'm here, so that I can be more and more empowered. Recently, Oklahoma Watch did a story on one of our participants, Tabitha Kincannon. And one of the things that we are a non-funded organization, but our heart are for the women who don't qualify for certain health resources. So our goal is to help empower them to be able to get the things that they need. So we do a lot of networking in the community, so to speak. But there are times where we would just like to be able to get help the first time for the individuals, without being told, well, they don't qualify for this or they don't qualify for that. They're still human beings. And what do you think would be the best solution other than awareness? We all know it's the biggest, mental illness is the biggest thing that's going on with the women in our community. What would be the best way to help women who they may or may not know that they have an illness like this, but if they do, they can immediately be assessed or taken care of immediately without going through a lot of hoops?
Unfortunately, because of the lack of funding. I mean, there are resources, especially in Tulsa, there are resources. But when you say, I want to be able to get somebody help, they're ready for help, there may not be funding available, even for somebody you think should qualify. And so most of us are nonprofits, and we want to help, but we have to, you know, be able to pay our employees. Let me tell you what I did. I started getting politically active, and I started talking to my legislators, and I started going to the Capitol and pounding the pavement and saying, look, I vote, and this matters to me, and this should matter to you, and started writing and emailing and doing everything that I could to talk about this, to scream at the top of my lungs. You all have to pay attention, because I know there's somebody in your family. I know one day somebody will need to access treatment. And so I think also something that you can do is learn about the resources. There are little fine-tuned places that can do specific screenings. I know our organization will screen anybody for anything. It doesn't matter. We will screen. We may not be able to get them into treatment because we may not have funding, but if we can, we will. And we will get on and help them go on the federal exchange and see if they qualify that way. We can see if they qualify for Sooner Care. There's lots of resources. You kind of have to know how to navigate a very broken system and get with, like, the Mental Health Association. They know about different resources, too. But it is difficult. It is difficult. Even when you get somebody who wants treatment and you want to help them, sometimes it's hard to access services.
Dr. Washington?
I think resources is the main thing. I think Tulsa has more resources than most areas. I think people just tend to not always know what those resources are. So the Mental Health Association has groups that you can go to. NAMI has groups for people with illness, for relatives of people dealing with the illness. They meet, you know, once a month, and Rose is sitting there and she answers the phone all day. And, you know, that's someone that, you know, getting to know. If someone's in a crisis, where I work is a good place for them to come to if they're in a crisis. I'm at Crisis Care Center. People just walk in and say, hey, I need to be evaluated. And they're a triage therapist who will figure out, okay, what resources do you have to pay for what you need, and I'll point you where to go. If that's inpatient, we can try to find them an inpatient bed. If that's, oh, you need to follow up on an outpatient basis, we can do that. And those are things that they can be triaged, and you don't necessarily have to make a bunch of calls. So I think figuring out what those resources are and just plugging into them, and sometimes people just don't know what those resources are. Tulsa has plenty.
I thought the Affordable Care Act was supposed to help us with this issue of access and affordability. So is it not moving the needle?
Okay, this is my hot topic, so you can just shut me down if you need to. So the Affordable Care Act, there's some holes in that system, and so there are loopholes, and even though it's parity and you're supposed to be able to access mental health and addiction treatment, there are finite loopholes. Most of the businesses in Oklahoma, and especially in Tulsa, are small business, and so if you're under 50 employees, you don't have to comply with that. A lot of people didn't know that because we did not expand Medicaid in our state. There's a huge gap of about 150,000 that don't qualify for the federal exchange and do not qualify for Sooner Care. And so a lot of people don't know that even though the Affordable Care Act happened, you still don't have access to the services that you need.
Ms. Hinther, you were going to say something about...
Oh, I was just going to, once she finds the resources, build relationships with those partners in our community so that they can help you as well.
Other questions? In the back.
I had a question for Ms. Hinther, but I should mention that I'm the medical student following Dr. Washington this month, and today a patient called me Doc and her Mrs. Washington.
There you go. I've,
in decades of working with the homeless people, I've seen many times in which a woman who has been trafficked most of her life has, to my horror, found a new boyfriend, and there is nothing I could say that would tell her to do anything different because this is the way she's always been. What successful technique have you ever seen that helped women like that?
The women who engage in prostitution, that's a hard behavior to figure out how to change because it's more money than they're making with a minimum wage job. It's quicker money than they make with a day-to-day job. And sometimes for them, with it being all that they know, when you're talking about the human trafficking, you only know what you know, so do a lot of education, a lot of work on empowering the woman, a lot of motivational interviewing techniques to see if she's wanting to change that behavior.
And heaven forbid they have any kind of legal history that prevents them from being able to, you know, have a felony on your record, and then background checks and, you know, jobs are difficult to come by.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And safe and stable housing.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And transportation.
Good question.
I'm just wondering how much of a problem the stigma is within African-American communities. And I'm looking at you, Ms. Washington. I'm sorry. But in North Tulsa, I think 75% of our population are single household, single-led by moms, single moms. And a lot of the men are incarcerated. They're just gone. And I think there's a pressure. There's just a necessity, a reality that women have to step up and take care of the family. A lot of times that's grandma, that's mom. Does that play into stigma, or is that more of a just we just can't take care of ourselves because there's not time?
A little bit of both, probably. I didn't grow up here. I grew up in Louisiana, and I grew up in an area probably similar to North Tulsa, and probably one of the reasons I became a psychiatrist, because I can remember, you know, we had two people I can think of in my neighborhood growing up who now looking back, I know they had schizophrenia, but they were just in the neighborhood. You know, they were just there hanging out, not treated, in the middle of the street, backing up traffic, cursing out people that weren't there, just doing them. And people just kind of let them be, which, you know, in a good way, you know, the community kind of let them do what they wanted to do. But I also saw a lot of people who were just very broken and had lots of trauma, and I can remember my grandma saying, you know, we don't go talk to some strange white man about all your problems, you know, we just don't do that, which was one of the reasons that I thought maybe I should go be a psychiatrist once I got through med school and kind of figured that out. So part of it is stigma, and part of it is, well, you know, some of it is, you know, it's the we don't do that. Like, generationally, you think about the African-American community, and especially the African-American community in Tulsa, you know, there's none of those people who were involved in the horrible trauma that happened to that community because they're not old enough, but those, like, generational hurts are still passed down. And those generational, we don't go past a certain line in the community, and we don't go. I live in Broken Arrow, and I used to go to church in North Tulsa, and nobody would come to my house. You would think I lived in Texas because they were like, oh, that's too far out. Like, we can't do that, you know. And there is a you know, kind of we're in here and we're stuck here in a way for some people who feel that way. And I think it's hard to break that. I think we have to give, you know, we have to give ourselves permission. And I think that if you're single and you, you know, are living in a low-income area and you are taking care of children and you just don't think about yourself. I mean, you just don't. My mom never thought about herself, ever. Never bought new clothes, still wearing stuff from the 80s to this day. Will not. I mean, it's just ingrained in you from generation to generation, and those are things that happen. I think we need to do more hitting our communities, like our African-American community and our Hispanic community, and just providing education. But I think part of that needs to be culturally competent education that is relevant and meets people where they are and meets them in the language that they understand with people that they can relate to. And I think sometimes those interventions that do happen are lost because the people that do it have all the best of intentions in the world, but I think sometimes they don't always meet people where they need to be met, how they need to be met, and then it ends up failing.
Other question?
Oh, okay. Hold on. She's afraid I'm going to keep it. a couple things. Two questions. Were you folks aware? Are you aware of the kind of the new barrier that we're seeing on substance abuse treatment? My opinion, with the having the a client now has to get an assessment called the ODASL,
yes,
and then put on a state waiting list. You're put on a state waiting list. And detox is impossible anymore. I've tried to do that. A couple folks that I work with, if they happen to get something open, it could be a detox bed in southeast Oklahoma, where transportation is getting there is another issue. I mean, are you guys aware of that, and how's that affecting your programs? My second question: is there anything out there, any legislative things happening to change the mental health system? It's not just a state problem. It's a national problem. But do any of you see anything changing along those lines?
Ms. Cizik, go ahead. Your treatment center specializes in substance abuse somewhat.
Okay, so the ODASL, that went live February 2nd, and what I want you to know is before that happened, there were over 2,000 Oklahomans on a waiting list to get into inpatient substance abuse treatment. Although the ODASL has been chaotic is probably the best word I can use in public, but it's helping to identify people. I think it has made it so only certain providers that are certified with the Department of Mental Health can do those and then put them on a waiting list. It's created some barriers. I think once the barriers are worked out, things will be better. Right now, before February, it was about a 6 month to 9 month waiting list where you would be on there before you would get treatment. Now we're seeing people get into treatment in 2 to 3 weeks, which is unbelievable. Women are slightly higher. Women with children getting into those programs are even slightly higher. So I do feel like there are several bumps, but I think it will get better as it goes. I would encourage you to find out who your providers are that can do those ODASLs. I know we have just a walk-in. You can just walk in and get an assessment, a screening, anytime you need to. And I think a lot of the outpatient providers have gone to that too. So that, I don't know if you have any...
Women in Recovery doesn't have to utilize that. Most of our participants come from Tulsa County Jail, and unfortunately that's their detox center.
I'm at where we are. We're on our inpatient side, a Medicaid facility, and we can work to have that assessment done in our facility. If someone comes in and is there for detox and says, I want to, and we can work at getting the assessment done in our facility if they're willing to stay there long enough to arrange to have someone come over and do it. We'll try to do it there before they leave.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think a lot of the outpatient providers were a little bit nervous because we didn't get any additional funding to do that screening. And so they were kind of holding out and waiting to see what was going to happen. And I think now that we've seen that not... The waiting list has gone down because I think there were so many duplicates that I think it will get better. I think it will definitely get better.
We'll take one more question if there's one out there.
Yeah, one question for Ms. Henther. Some of the studies out there say that over 75% of women have one mental health issue that are in local jails. And it seems, from what I understand, in Tulsa County, in the mental health ward of the Tulsa County Jail, that it's really a vicious cycle of women with issues that just go in, come right back, go out, come right back in, a revolving door. Give us a sense of just what you know, how bad the situation is there with women in mental health in the Tulsa County Jail.
I think that the Tulsa County Jail is... been limiting the use of medications for psychiatric needs because of many of the women that come in are there for drug charges. And so my understanding is that not sure if there's really a mental health issue because you can't quite get an accurate diagnosis unless someone's been sober for 6 months to a year. Not sure if that answers your question.
Okay. So, last question for each of you. If you could wave your magic wand and change one thing about our mental health care system, what would it be?
I'd ask for another 3 or 4 wands if that would be possible. I definitely think funding is a huge thing, but I think we really, really have to fundamentally change our healthcare system to a prevention-based screening for all different types of issues. I mean, we get to go to the dentist every 6 months and have our teeth checked. Why can't we have a place where everybody can go get a mental health wellness check every 6 months? It should just be a granted. Maybe 4 times a year.
All of the services for court-related needs in our community for felony convictions are all for high-risk, high-need female offenders. So I think the big gap in Tulsa is for misdemeanor charges, misdemeanor prostitution charges, the lower-risk female offenders that are getting probation on their first sentence or a deferred suspended sentence. on DA supervision, and they still don't have the resources that the women that I see at Women in Recovery, they don't have either. It's just I see them a little bit further down the line than their first-time offense. So I think some of those prevention services as well for offenders would help target, in the long run, our high rates of incarceration.
Yeah, I think if we can figure out a way to create systems that catch people before they get to that point, I think that would be it. And for the gray area people, they are people that live in gray zones. They are not sick enough for this service, but they're too sick for this service. They don't have enough of this to be in this program, mm-hmm. but they're too much to be in another program. And I think we, with lack of funding, has come these little gaps. And there are people that live in these gray zones who, unfortunately, it feels really bad to tell someone that, well, you have to get sicker before you can get what you really need, because there really isn't anything for you right now. So I would say that those gray area people.
Could I have one more wish?
Okay.
One more wish. So if somebody we know has a mental illness or addiction, rather than it be stigmatizing, probably their children should be screened early in preschool. They should start doing prevention stuff, and that should be part of their healthcare system too, as a, you know, hey, we know that this could be a possibility. We know this runs in family, and begin to treat and educate as early as possible, because we know the longer people go, typically they end up in prison, foster care, jail, I mean, you name it. So I just really feel fundamentally reducing stigma, increasing access to care.
Good point. Well, thanks very much. Please give our guests a hand. Excellent panel.